Welcome to the Command Line Podcast for December 9th, 2009. I'm your host, Thomas Command Line Gideon, a self-proclaimed hacker, eccentric, and hacktivist. This is my show about the practice and profession of programming, drawing on well over a decade of professional experience and a lifetime spent hacking, the intersection of technology with society and public policy, and anything else clever, elegant, or funny that catches my mind as a diehard technology geek. This episode is a feature cast. In it, I have a new monologue on the subject of the social gravity well. I also have a new hacker word of the week. First, though, I wanted to give a long overdue quick review of the film Astro Boy. I'm actually going to go ahead and include a link in the show notes to Dan the Fan's wonderful review of this up at the blog Geekadelphia. I went into this film hoping that it would be in some respects similar to my experience of WALL-E, that is that given that robotic technology is so interwoven with the story, that there would be that same sort of hacker trickster sort of protagonist, but this tells a very different tale about the role of technology. It actually hinges on this question of whether being human is a function of being flesh and blood, or being human is a function of just having heart and how you act towards others. So really not so much a technology tale as such. At the risk of spoiling this somewhat if you're unfamiliar with the property, it is, well, a retelling of Pinocchio, though it comes with some gorgeous set dressing. I have to say, in terms of the visual translation of Osamu Tezuka's original masterpiece, I think that this plays incredibly well. In terms of sharing this with your geek kids, I think that there's very little to be concerned here with, especially for older or less sensitive kids. If you have much younger kids, you may want to wait on this one, because there are scenes where there's a bit of robot against robot violence that might be problematic for the very youngest. And to be fair, also, the society that's kind of at the center of this story does have somewhat of a disturbing attitude towards the robots themselves in terms of treating them as disposable technology. And for the very most sensitive kids out there, that might be an issue as well. But I think that there's an element of humor that's even woven into that aspect of the story that might make it tolerable for a kid who otherwise might be upset by that. On the balance, though, I wholeheartedly recommend this film for you, for your entire family. It's just very enjoyable, with just the couple of drawbacks that Dan notes in his review, and I'll repeat just briefly here that some of the voice acting is maybe a little stilted, maybe not to the same quality that the majority of the voice acting is in this film. But really, because the rest of the cast does such a stellar job, and because the rendering and the visuals are just so gorgeous, it more than makes up for it. And like I said, without reservation, I can say, if you haven't seen it already, granted it came out several weeks ago, you should definitely go see this, or seek this out when it hits the DVD, Blu-ray, or streaming markets. Listener feedback this week came in from Philip, who wrote me an email in response to my rant on the 18th entitled Nowhere to Go. And he writes, "What about Ken Thompson co-creating Go at age 66? Would a technical role like he holds be something to aspire to? Maybe being a distinguished engineer would offer satisfaction to you." The first big difference, unfortunately, is that Thompson started out as an academic, and I've always been self-taught. So I think the comparison there is a bit flawed. He also was fortunate enough to work in a corporate lab during the heyday of those. Granted, there still are corporate labs out there, but they're fewer, and I think they're far more exclusive as a consequence. So if you don't have that strong academic background, I don't really see the likelihood of getting hired by, say, Microsoft's research division or something comparable to that. Also, Thompson has graduate degrees in both electrical engineering and computer science, so I wouldn't look at his invention of the Go programming language, to which he contributed. He wasn't the sole inventor, I believe that's correct. I wouldn't look at that as the standalone feat pulled off by a self-taught hacker. I think that that's a little disingenuous to suggest that. I appreciate the sentiment, but his is a better example of the avenues that an academic career can open up. When my kids are older, perhaps I may reconsider the option of going back to school. It just isn't practical right now. On better days, I'm resigned to collecting a paycheck at whatever small software firm will hire me until my life circumstances ultimately change enough to consider those other options. Even though you haven't really persuaded me to see things differently than I did when I shared that rant, I really do appreciate the thoughtful email, Philip. Thanks a lot. If any of the rest of you have some thoughts to add on that rant or anything else I talk about in the show, feel free to send those to feedback@thecommandline.net. The hacker word of the week comes from the jargon file maintained by Eric Raymond at catb.org. Exec. Noun. 1. Unix from execute. Synonym for chain. Derives from the exec2 call. 2. From executive. Obsolete. The command interpreter for an OS, C#. Term especially used around mainframes, and probably derived from UNIVAC's archaic exec2 and exec8 operating systems. 3. At IBM and VM CMS shops, the equivalent of a shell command file among VM CMS users. The mainstream exec as an abbreviation for human executive is not used. To a hacker, an exec is always a program, never a person. When I don't have enough bile for a rant, and can't muster the necessary peace and serenity for an inner chapter, all that's left is for me to express my evil genius side and do a monologue. In the commentaries that I've been listening to and reading online, I've been increasingly hearing a dichotomy between the web viewed as pages and the web viewed as some sort of stream of information. Jeff Jarvis constantly contrasts these two on the podcast that a listener, Philip, turned me on to a little while ago, This Week in Google. Mostly this is when he's talking about Twitter, actually. And I think it stems from Dave Weiner's notion, his suggestion of this river of news that you could kind of dip in and consume just when you want to and otherwise allow it to just flow by without getting too angsty about not catching every little last thing. The implication, too, is that rather than browsing to specific destinations online, you are partaking in a push-based, approaching real-time web where information flows past you as a passive receiver. There is something to this comparison. You do communicate differently through social messaging, even if you're not engaging in personal conversation, but a broader conversation. And you certainly receive information differently with some of the latest social innovations. New services entering the space have to understand the difference, really, where they're going to fall out amongst those two camps. But I don't think that these two distinct points tell the entire story. This actually, when you think about the web as a stream or Weiner's river of news, it actually in many ways sounds to me a lot like traditional broadcast. Without a DVR, you're subject to the whims of network programming. You could talk about dipping your toe into the stream of broadcast news, that you watch what's available when you have the time, and otherwise you let go of the things that you're not there to consume when they're programmed. The biggest difference between the stream and traditional broadcast, though, is the barrier to entry in participation. The nature of programming is kind of different, too, to be fair. In the stream, content is dictated by your social connections. Even more so than a broadcast, every person's experience of that passive flow will be quite different. The difference in that potential difference is also quite immense. The unique character of streams, then, is a function of possible combinations of social connections who produce information. The basis of my objection, why I compare these stream-oriented, flow-oriented models to traditional media, is the implication of passivity. Maybe that is a function of a different scale that I just haven't reached yet in my utilization of social messaging. I mean, Dunbar's number, I'll include a link to that notion in the show notes, sets a physiologically rooted limit on meaningful social connections, about 150. Maybe well past that limit, when the only useful way to approach information is more with passive immersion than active engagement, then we see the models that these guys are suggesting. Thank you. I don't think enough emphasis is placed on the continuum between these two models. Streams suggest high volume, low interactivity. Pages suggest lesser volume and greater potential interactivity. And contrasting the two, I think Jarvis makes it sound like one excludes the other. Stop and think about that for a moment. What would Twitter or Identica be like without anything longer, anything deeper that you would actually link through to, that you would click and read? It's kind of like the suggestion that SMS will replace phone calls, or that IM, instant messaging, will replace email. As a function of their different qualities and different media, they're going to operate at different volumes and speeds. As an example, I have just under 2,000 posts on my blog. I have well over 7,000 tweets on my Twitter account. My blog is at least twice as old as my Twitter account, too, making that difference all the more telling. As a writer, I would feel utterly stifled if my microblog outright replaced my proper blog. I think gravity is a more nuanced metaphor for talking about these different models. Social messaging is like high orbits undertaken at high speed, high velocity. Blogs and content sites are like sitting deeper in the gravity well at lower orbits with stronger gravitational pull. You could chart any number of media on this wonderful hyperbolic curve. I think the metaphor is even richer than that. Too long didn't read, TLDR, becomes a case of failing orbital capture. Think about clawing out of a particularly engaging blog post, pulling your way up out of that gravitational pull of compelling content. Or even sites that have a strong mimetic draw could be thought of as sort of singularities, black holes. Wikipedia inducing a click trance, like being dragged, even if you are a photon skimming at the speed of light through the infosphere, down past the Schwarzschild radius, down past the event horizon. Irregularly read sources form sort of eccentric orbits like comets or wandering planets. There is almost infinite space to explore how content fits into this model, not necessarily limited to just low gravity or high orbital speed versus low orbital speed. The well could include related strands, stretching content across orbits, like an orbital tether with masses orbiting at different velocities, but the whole moves together in the same gravity well as one construct. This becomes useful, like a space elevator, for more easily moving deeper into a gravity well and back again. Bookmarks are an extremely early construct that matches this idea, dropping a tag at high orbit that allows returning and falling in much easier, like a pre-plotted trajectory or course. A blog post deep in the well could be redacted into a status update. Each end of the pairing between a social message and the post that it links back to moves at the appropriate speed in the well. Readers can move along the tether in between them, depending on the changing availability of their attention. A high-speed capture could result in someone sinking into the well. Personally, I use the higher orbits to quickly collect links. Then, when I have time later, I allow myself to be drawn in much more deeply. Instead of thinking about delta V, reaction mass, to overcome a gravitational pull due to the curvature of space and time itself. In this model, we can think about attention as being the fuel that we need to spend in order to move between and differentiate these orbits. At higher velocity, each item needs to be cheaper by definition, and this maps well with more expensive items attention-wise sitting deeper in the social gravity well. It also matches well with the cost of production. Higher orbital traffic makes up the link economy. Readers speeding from well to well without necessarily getting trapped, social messaging as pure gravitational slingshots to move people in between different wells, it doesn't require any sort of stopping along the way. Actually, you can have acceleration as a function of flyby, that the attention cost is minimal, but it drags you onwards to the next thing. It's easier for some kinds of content to be spat out as these sort of pithy, higher velocity messages, especially for linking to pre-existing items with simple comments, with annotations. Such content speeds up discovery of those more interesting, deeper items. It is harder to develop an editorial character, though, this way, though I do think it is possible. It relies more on how the selectivity of the things that you're casting into those higher orbits, how that then starts to reveal your choices through the volume of things that you're throwing up there. Aggregators like Dig, Boing Boing, Metafilter already act as a form of orbital catapult, shooting readers all over the infosphere. The older model sites like these have a bit more drag to them. They add a bit more commentary, offering more of a kind of a way station, more so than the high-velocity social messaging. They do track orbits, though, that are more complex, more nuanced, and are capable of showing a strong editorial character with a lower volume, like the idiosyncrasies of some bespoke orbital escape craft. Different placement of thrusters, vagaries of the mass and the size of the central body, the center of gravity, lead to a very different ride in, out, and around these richer sort of midpoint orbits in the gravity well. I follow very few people who create content that exists solely in those high orbits, shooting past at the same velocity as a satellite. Usually it's highly original and creative content. For example, R. Stevens, creator of the wonderful webcomic Diesel Sweeties, posts all kinds of quips and non sequiturs that stand alone. Who out there is not familiar with the story of Shit My Dad Says? It's a fairly unique example as far as it goes. These short quotes, just enough to deliver a punch, and some of it relying on the accumulated context, the sort of ongoing monologue from the writer's notional father. I mean, maybe it is really his dad, but it's kind of, like I said, it builds on itself in a way to expand and establish that voice. I think it defies some of the examples I gave previously of lower cost to move things into those higher orbits. To be clear, I think actually the lower cost here is in terms of our attention. I think there's actually a higher boosting cost. It takes a greater amount of energy to pull off the things that these guys do, these examples that I provided. And some of the content in this mode, I don't think actually would stand up to the shearing pressures, if you will, of being under greater gravitational force, of that sustained attention deeper in the gravity well, the social gravity well. Shit My Dad Says, I think, would be a lot harder to turn into a traditional series of single-page blog posts. It would have to change substantially, becoming far more of a traditional sort of narrative in order to stand up to that, like a spacecraft needing to be able to withstand those different stresses, providing different amounts of thrust to maintain higher and lower orbits. So a good creator, like a fluent orbital mechanic, if you will consciously consider the full span of that social gravity well. We already have many publishers that are successful in spanning that simpler model, going beyond it, acting as better examples of orbital tethers, catapults, slingshots, and the like. Many people already naturally are using plugins to link blog posts with social messages. Others have explored similar, but even more involved models. I actually received several email newsletters, and I have for some time, that I think many of them actually predate microblogs. And all of these also have blogs, which post the same content. The email digest is sort of a medium velocity vehicle. It offers more than the 140 characters of social messaging, but it still relies on the links to the full piece out at the site. It is nowhere near as quick to review as social messages, but offers more detail at a slightly higher attention cost. The deeper wells become, the more options authors actually have. Likewise, the better the technology, the easier to explore that full range the social gravity well has to offer. I don't think there's any limit, really, other than perhaps the shearing forces of trying to put things that are too dissimilar together. If two different orbits are paired, then the reader may experience a bit something like whiplash or gravitational crushing. The burden is on content producers to find these comfortable combinations. The more effective ones will see more readers spending more attention across the full range of the available space. Those are just some of my thoughts, like I said, ruminating on some of the conversation around the emergence of different kinds of media. I'm curious to hear what you think, whether you disagree, you have other examples, and you have your own thoughts to supplement, I think, this rich extended metaphor of a social gravity well. As always, if you send those in to me, I'd be happy to share them with everybody else. That's going to do it for this episode. As always, I want to thank you for listening. And if you enjoyed the program, please go to the website at thecommandline.net and click the support link to find ways where you can help out by making a donation, purchasing some swag, or downloading a promo in order to help tell a friend. If you have a question, suggestion, or correction, you can send those to feedback@thecommandline.net, or you're welcome to post a comment up on the website. If you're away from your computer and the internet at the moment, call Listener Comment Line at area code 240-949-2638. The next show, which should go out in the feed Sunday night as usual, will be a news program, so until then, don't forget to hack your world. I would like to thank Liberated Syndication and Wouta DB for media hosting and bandwidth. This show is produced from 100% recycled bits, and permission to recycle those further, except where noted, is granted under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial Share-alike 3.0 United States license. That means you're allowed to change and share this file as long as you share your changes, maintain attribution, and don't commercialize it without permission.